Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring the stories that make the incredible world of tech and venture tick. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to the founders, investors, and ecosystem operators trying to make a dent in the future. Hello and welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I'm super excited to have Melissa Snover with me. Melissa is an award-winning serial entrepreneur and is pioneering change at the intersection of food technology and 3D printing. She is currently founder and CEO of Remedy Health, which has spearheaded personalized solutions in both nutrition and medicine under their Nourished and Scripted brands. Really great to have you here with me today, Melissa.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
No, thank you for joining. So look, jumping straight in, you're no stranger to fundraising, having previously set the record for the largest seed round raised by a female founder back in 2020. But it hasn't been without its struggles, whether that was kind of leaving the dragon's den without an investment for a previous business or navigating the world of VC. What do you wish you knew then that you know now? And what would you have done differently?
Yeah, hindsight is a fantastic thing, isn't it? But I think, you know, to start off, I'll say I don't regret anything that's happened so far. If anything, I'm quite thankful and grateful for a lot of the things that didn't go as I wanted them to at the time, because I think they actually led me to the path that I'm on now and where I am. And I'm very happy. I wouldn't want to be anywhere else. My mom has a saying, some of God's greatest gifts are unanswered prayers. And it's something that I repeat in my head when I don't get my way. But at the same time, I think it is important to have reflection and to think about it. And I think, you know, I've been an entrepreneur since I was 23. I've raised money in lots of different ways, from friends and family. I've remortgaged my house. And really only when I started the Remedy Health Group in 2019 did I start raising what is, you know, VC funding style funding. So going out and looking for venture capital. And that was a massive learning curve. I'd never done anything like it. And I learned more in that period of time than I had done in probably the past 5 years. And that was quite a short period of time. What did I learn? I mean, I learned that saying no is the most powerful tool a manager has. And whether you're managing your own time or whether you're managing people's expectations or whether you're managing your own team, I think it's really powerful. And I think when I started doing it, I was so worried that I was going to miss out on an opportunity. And I also had such little experience in understanding, you know, who was who, what was serious, what was an analyst doing research, wasting my time, that I said yes to everything. And I really know a lot more now, and I would do it maybe a bit differently. And I certainly did do it differently in my Series A. The second thing I would love to have known, or maybe just, I guess, taken more seriously at the time was, you know, the people you bring into your business in a round of any kind, whether you just take money from a friend, whether you take money from a bank, whether you take money from a VC, those you better be comfortable with being alongside that person or entity for a period of 5 years or longer. And so you really need to look at it like a relationship. And if you don't enjoy working with that person, if you don't enjoy conversating with them, if you don't think that that's going to be a relationship that's going to bring you and your business positive energy, support, etc., you need to walk away from it, because there is always going to be more money, but your mental health and the well-being and the energy within your business is a finite thing. And if you allow too much of that in, you can really be in a bad situation. And one of the things that happened to me is I ended up having to do in my Series A a really massive secondary, almost as big as the primary, to be able to get, you know, some people who I had brought in the beginning out and then bring in better people to be able to support our business. And that was really the kind of result of that learning that I took in action.
So I think there is a lot to unpack there. The first thing that would be great to unpack is, you know, saying no is more important than saying yes. I think for a lot of founders that haven't raised externally before, they get quite excited by being in the room with investors, but it's a very asymmetric relationship. You know, those investors are there with one, you know, I think the biggest realization for a lot of people is that venture capitalists, especially, yes, they may have some angle around innovation, but what they are really there to do is to return capital to their LPs, i.e. the people that have invested in their funds. And therefore, you've got to know who the right people to talk to, are and who is wasting your time. I think so. Saying no is definitely a big lesson for anyone, not just with raising capital, but I think in life in general. I think it's really interesting that you had to go through a massive secondary. And just for the information of our listeners, a secondary round is where incoming investors will buy out some of the existing investors, and a primary round, as you mentioned, is where they bring fresh capital into the business. So I guess that's, you know, without going into the specifics, I've come across in numerous occasions like poorly structured cap tables, and that's an example of where a cap table maybe has been set up in the wrong way, and, you know, later investors have come in and said, well, we'll only invest if, right? So I think those are hard learned lessons, but they're definitely lessons worth paying attention to. So the pandemic led to like a massive boost in demand for nutraceuticals, right? So there was a report by PwC that estimated that the vitamins and dietary supplements category will grow to 113 almost billion euros by 2023. That sounds like a great market to be in, but there are a lot of players in the space. So what would you say sets Nourished apart?
Yeah, that's a really good point. The market is huge, and it was already huge before the pandemic. And now it's just really brought in a whole new set of shoppers to the category that maybe weren't playing in it before. So it is an exciting place to be. But yeah, I think one of the things that is really paramount to me in every business that I set up and every venture that I do is that we are so violently against Me Too products, right? So I really don't understand what someone would be thinking about when they decide to set out to go, I'm just going to make this with one small change. It's just not how my brain works. I really believe that in order for you to have enough passion to be able to put everything that you are into something, you have to be creating a really, really monumental and material level of disruption and creating a better solution. And that's what we've done with Nourished. So with Nourished, we've taken a bunch of things that are already super hot as macro trends. So the first one is personalization. I think, you know, there's already existing people who have been out in the market like Carev in the United States, who basically established this idea that everybody's different. The idea that you take a single multivitamin and it's fine for everyone, it doesn't work. It's a flawed idea. And this idea is absolutely paramount to our product and kind of the background of it. Whereas people in the past, like Carev, have done something where they've taken multiple vitamin tablets from different providers and put them into a sachet. So basically curating or co-packing a special set of items which are already made for you in their personalization concept. We've gone like 10 steps further, and we actually manufacture a unique gummy vitamin with 7 unique elements that are unique for every person. We don't have any stock on demand. We don't buy product from other people. We manufacture everything ourselves. And we do this through the power of 3D printing, of which all of our technology is proprietary, patented, and developed by us. And so this 3D printing technology allows us to create single batch product, which is unique to each person. And in addition to that, you know, you have this format trend around chewables or non-pill formats. And you see this in the PwC report. You also see it in a massive Mintel report that came out at the end of last year. You know, people under the age of 35 are taking their vitamins in chewable formats and non-pill formats. And so we're also the only gummy vitamin in the world that is personalized. And that's only possible because of that 3D printing technology. There's a lot of other things that come alongside of it, and there's a lot of other benefits. Fresher vitamins are better for you. It's quite sensible, actually, if you think about it. But if you make a vitamin 2 years ago and then have it, you know, that much later, you're not going to get the same level of benefit. And obviously, you can change your flavors. It's more enjoyable. It's more convenient and so forth. But really, it's about this kind of intersection of vitamins and supplements as a proactive health choice, as opposed to a reactive health solution. So instead of taking iron because you're anemic, it's about, I'm going to take ashwagandha to improve my mental health, right? So this is really where the new customer looks. Then you've got personalization, which we do better and more aggressively than anyone in the world. Then you've got the gummy form factor. And those three things together have really helped us to go out to market relatively quickly and gain a really fast and very devoted following for the product range.
So there's a couple of things there that I think are really interesting. One is this trend towards health prevention, like preventative measures rather than kind of sickness care. So healthcare, true healthcare rather than sickness care. And I think that point you made around people moving towards being more proactive rather than reactive is really, really interesting. And the second is personalization, which I'd love to dig into more, because we're moving closer to a world of personalization almost every aspect of our lives, from what we consume on the television to how we're delivered education, or even, I guess, the clothes, right? So it must be hugely technically challenging to solve this. But is the challenge in the software, i.e. identifying what the consumer wants, or in the hardware actually producing what they want? Because you're actually playing in both of those fields. And it's I think it's super interesting to understand where the technical challenge lies.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So the software or the recommendation determinants can be done in so many different ways. Now, we have a phenotyping questionnaire, which is linked to an intelligent logic algorithm, which has an AI protocol, which is benchmarking and baselining against over 10 million peer-reviewed medical studies on a daily basis, second by second. And that produces a recommendation. So ours is highly sophisticated, but there are lots of other ways that you could do it. You could do it by a series of blood tests over a period of time. Not one blood test, that will never give you an accurate level. But if you took blood tests every third day for 6 weeks, you could use that. You could use biometric information and health data coming from a wearable technology. That would give you information about the recommendation. But what your question was, which is a really good one, I'm glad you asked, is where is the real challenge? Why is not everything personalized? And the technical challenge is the manufacturing of the actual personalized product once you know what needs to go in it. And really, I spent my early career about 7 years in big mainstream factories, humongous monstrosity buildings with massive lines, making millions and millions and millions and millions of the same thing. And those are pretty much responsible for like 99% of all produced product, edible or non-edible, those types of format factories. And those factories are great at making the same thing over and over and making it at a reasonable price point for the consumer. But what they absolutely cannot do is even small batch product, never mind an individualized item. It's absolutely impossible. And so what we've done is, I basically was in this world of big manufacturing. I sold my previous company and I thought there's got to be a different way. There's got to be a way that we can make the product the customer wants there and then when they want it. And that was really when I started looking at 3D printing. And with 3D printing, just, you know, there's so many kinds of 3D printing. The PR around 3D printing is a little bit nuts. It makes it sound a little bit futuristic. But actually, a 3D printer is a robot that is a miniature factory. And our 3D printers are as big as my desk. They're not very big. I could fit, I don't know, 20 of them in my office. And each one of them is enclosed, fully automated. And each one of them is a miniature large format factory making a one batch product at a time. And that is really what we have done differently. And that's our power to be able to do something that nobody's ever done. And it's not that we're unique in VMS. We're unique in manufacturing full stop, because really up until now, 3D printing has been either too slow or too limited in its materials. And then big manufacturing has been too large format and not being able to be personalized. And we're really the first one to come to the middle and bring them together and make something that's scalable, but that also can make a totally unique item every time.
So again, there's a couple of things I'd like to unpack there. So firstly, I come from a manufacturing background, right? And exactly to your point, manufacturing is all around how do you repeat a process as efficiently as possible? And therefore, how do you standardize everything? And I think, you know, there's a great book, The End of Averages. And I think we're moving further and further away from this theory of averages where everything should be made the same for everyone because not everyone is the same. And the question that kind of arises from that is with the 3D printers, yes, you can now personalize, but how scalable is that, I guess, right? Like how easy is it to scale, you know, your 3D printers where they're producing small batches from, you know, 1 to 100 to 1,000? Like, are there economies of scale? Or is there a scaling issue with the 3D printers? Or do you find that as the technology has advanced, you can now produce at capacity or near kind of, you know, traditional manufacturing capacity with the 3D printers?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. I get asked this question quite a lot, especially by big manufacturing. And, you know, I think it's an interesting one. So with traditional manufacturing, and you'll know this if you come from that background, you often find that the pricing for items is around volume. The more volume that you buy, the cheaper that the individual unit cost becomes. Because basically, if they can keep the line on doing the same thing for longer, they get efficiencies, they get economies of scale. You then get that as the end buyer, right? And with 3D printing, if I made you 1 million of the same Aresh vitamins, or I made you one box of Aresh vitamins, the price for me to make it is the same. And so although that makes it sound like we're less powerful, it's actually far more powerful. And in effect, we are able to bring out product. So if you order product from us today, you'll have it by the third day. The total production time for the product from start to finish to in a box ready to go out the door is less than 30 minutes. In a large scale factory, it's around 5 days for a food product of a similar nature. So actually we are faster. And the difference is when we scale, we just make more 3D printers as opposed to we put longer conveyor belt lines or we add another mogul. We're actually literally making additional 3D printers. And where I'm sitting right now today, I'm sitting in our food factory. I'm on the top floor. I sit in the MPD area. Across the road is my machine building center. So over there, our tech team is basically talking all the time to production. And as soon as they see production is hitting a slightly uncomfortable level of stress on their capacity, the tech team builds them more 3D printers. And we can build a new 3D printer in around 2.5 days. The cost to build a printer once you've designed it and when you have that in-house capability is relatively low. We make the 3D printer with other 3D printers. So we 3D print the 3D printer. It's not 100% 3D printed though. That's a really important caveat. We're not trying to say that. But at the end of the day, that power and that in-house capability and the speed at which we can scale up in a way which is totally controllable product, like basically machine by machine, is A, it's really cost effective because I'm not having to invest hundreds of thousands in a new, you know, line every time we hit a certain level. But also it's way faster and space efficient. So, you know, we can make 50,000 boxes a month in my current factory. If this was a large scale factory, I don't think you could even put one line in here.
So again, it's kind of flipped things on its head, right? Because effectively what you're talking about is efficiency that can't be gained from large scale manufacturing. In fact, it's better to be small scale because you can turn on and off as required. Whereas with large scale manufacturing, you are bound by the capacity of your existing equipment, and to scale up, you either have to buy a whole new piece of kit, or you have to build a whole new site, or you have to do something equivalent to that to be able to scale up manufacturing. So what you're actually saying is you have effectively got a model whereby you can scale up and down production to your needs at low cost and at low, or sort of with a high level of speed, I guess, which just means that you can be much more reactive to the market, right? I think that's super interesting. And the second thing that came to mind was very recently, Dave Friedberg, who's very famous from the All In podcast, I guess, announced, I think it's called Canna, and they have developed, well, I don't think they're 3D printers, but they're definitely kind of out there in terms of Star Trekiness, the sort of drinks dispensing machines that are now, with a limited number of molecular ingredients, able to create flavor combinations to match any drink. So I think we are definitely heading down the path of greater and greater personalization, which I think is fantastic. And talking about manufacturing, there was a quote from the Investment Monitor, which was quite telling, I think. You know, it said, British manufacturing isn't dead, but it is not entering the post-COVID and new Brexit landscape from a position of health. Although some of the reasons for that have been beyond the UK's control, others have looked perilously close to managed decline at times. Now, I think about that, and that to me suggests that we're in a kind of negative environment for manufacturing, but you have two factories in Digbeth with a third coming live at the end of Q1 2022 and employing close to 100 people. So what's it like actually being a manufacturer in the UK today? And for other founders thinking about launching physical production, what advice would you give to them?
Yeah, that's a great question. Before I get into it though, I just want to say I love the All In podcast, and I've seen that product that you're talking about, Canna. It's a really interesting idea and I really love it. And I think it's gonna open up this really kind of idea around people being able to create something and transfer it exactly to another place and then make it again. There's so many different ways that you can do that. Although a drinks dispenser is not a 3D printer, it has to be a solid material for it to be a 3D printer, but they did a great job. Now, onto your real question, manufacturing in a large economy like the UK has been challenging for a long time, way before COVID hit, right? Because in general, when you have a high labor requirement for manufacturing, you want to go to places where you can find large spaces for less expensive, more people who want to work in that type of an environment. And that's why you find find less and less manufacturing in these more, you know, service-based cultures, etc. However, that being said, where I am in the Midlands is probably the hub of manufacturing still when it comes to hardware. We have Jaguar Land Rover around the corner from us, and there is still very much a manufacturing heart in the Midlands. And so what I see in the Midlands is a huge support network for manufacturing where I didn't see in other areas in the UK. So maybe that's just my experience, but that's what I've seen. And I think when COVID hit, and after COVID and Brexit at the same time, and that man is absolutely right, that is a horrible, horrible combination of events right after another to happen at the same time. You had a perfect storm of labor shortage, people getting sick, supply chain issues, transport issues, delivery problems. It basically everything went wrong when it came to making a product. And really for us, we were born 8 weeks before COVID hit. So our brand launched into the market 8 weeks before COVID. And certainly I planned the business model knowing that Brexit was coming. And so I think that the way I set it up, although it was highly complex and more costly, I think, than other people would have done it, it served us very well because we are an end-to-end full stack manufacturer with in-house capability, which has allowed us to continue in times that other people were not able to continue because of their dependency on supply chain, third-party goods in and out, import and export, where we have a 98% UK-based supply chain for our raw materials. We work with local companies on the few things that we do bring into house, and that's really helped us. Now, in relation to labor, again, 3D printers are robots, right? In the strictest sense of the term, they are robots. And so our facility and our manufacturing is highly automated. And so that also has helped us a lot. Now, it's not 100% automated and I have a lot of staff, but for the level of product that we put out, I have, you know, 1/5 of the amount of staff that you might find in a different type of manufacturing facility. That also helps, right? But in the end, manufacturing in the old fashioned way, the mainstay way that is currently the mainstay status quo is going to have to change for many reasons, for environmental reasons, for the way that its dependency on labor, for the limitations that they have around supply chain and access to product, to the Brexit walls closing. All of those things within the UK are going to change. But does that mean it's going to get worse? Absolutely not. It's going to get quite rocky, and it is rocky. It's been rocky. But in these types of rocky environments, I'm sure that you have had other people say this on this pod. I'm sure you've read books saying the same thing. The greatest ideas and entrepreneurs and businesses are born in times of what people would say are great challenge. There's huge opportunity to make change in these types of times. And I think that's what we're trying to embrace and that we see really happening in our specific area and in the manufacturing type that we've set up.
Yeah, I think it's really important to remember, I'm a very much anti-Brexit. Those that know me will certainly back me up. My wife is Italian, and you know, I found the Brexit debate quite depressing at many times. I think there are lots of negatives, but I think we can't assume that it's all negative, and that there have to be or will be massive benefits that should flow just from the nature of kind of deregulation and various other aspects that the government is trying to now kind of put through. And I think it's great to have that optimism that, you know what, yes, manufacturing has taken a hit. There are definitely some industries that have been battered by Brexit, but equally there are opportunities coming through that we have to take advantage of. So I'm not a fan of Brexit, but I think there are definite benefits that will come through over time. Nothing Ventured, this podcast is all about taking, you know, the entrepreneurial plunge. And an interview that you did with Balance, they asked what your plan B was. And I loved your response, right? You said, I think that if you go into any business thinking about plan B, you'll never be focused or enthusiastic enough to achieve your goal. With a good idea, the right team, and lots of dedication and passion, you can achieve anything. So safety nets often hold you back rather than push you forward. So what advice would you give to people considering entrepreneurship today? How should they think about that approach to risk?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. And I forgot about that interview. I think I'm a mentor to a lot of people, young and old. It's not a specific age demographic, but people wanting to start their own businesses, all sorts of different stages, all different kinds of businesses. And one of the questions that I get asked more frequently than I than I expected to is, how do I know when I should quit? And that is really along the same lines of what I said in that interview, which is my answer to them is, if that is a question that you're asking, then you should not even start. If you have a view in your mind that you're going to do this for a period of time, and then in case it doesn't work out, you're going to keep this other thing on the side, you don't feel passionate about it enough that it keeps you awake at night, that it's the thing that you want to do more than anything, then that's not your thing. You need to keep looking. And it's not a good idea to start an entrepreneurial journey with something that you don't feel absolutely running through your blood, keeping you awake, helping you to sleep in your dreams, you know, amount of passion for. And I think, you know, the things that I've done in my career have been things that I believed in very, very much. I've never done something that I didn't believe in. I don't think I could do it. I don't think I would do it well. And that is what keeps me going. And oh my God, I have challenges now that if I faced when I was younger, I think I would have lost it. I think I would have gone over that cliff. And now I look at it and it's because I have experience. I have confidence in our ability to be able to overcome it over time. But that kind of level of challenge coming at you on a daily basis from all sides, plugging holes in a dam all day long, and as soon as you think you've got it, another one goes, you will not be able to continue unless you love it so much and you are so committed, not interested, but committed to it, that you have no other alternative, nor do you want to have one. You know, you're not wishful thinking for another idea. You really believe so much in what you're doing. So if you feel that way about anything, then you absolutely owe it to yourself and the world to do something about it, because that type of passion results in you having a better life if you pursue it. And also usually results in a better world for the world. So if you're creating a new product that helps people's lives, if you've got a new technology that improves the environment, if you're going to provide a service that is going to offer something that doesn't exist now, that is missing in people's day-to-day, or is it missing in the healthcare industry, missing in for whatever. I mean, it could be a zillion different things. But that kind of passion is a sign that you need to take action and do something about it. And if you haven't found that yet, it's not the end of the world. Lots of people, it takes them more than half their life to find it. But what I wish, what I tell the people I mentor is, don't just pick something that you think is trending, that you think you can make a good margin on, because that's not being an entrepreneur, that's being an opportunist. And there are better and easier and less stressful ways to make money than to be an entrepreneur. And you have to really love what you do for you to get the full circle benefit of doing it.
I think that's 100% correct. The idea of doing what I do as an example, and I'm sure it's the same for you, the idea of not doing what I do, I think is something that keeps me up at night. Not, is it the right time to quit? But it's like, okay, where do we go from here? And I think, you know, that question that people pose you, how do I know when I should quit? I think is really telling, because the greatest entrepreneurs I know are very resilient. They will have dips for sure. They will go through periods where they think they should quit, or they just really wish that, you know, the tables were turned in some way and they had, you know, they had money in the bank or the right person in the team or whatever it is, right? But it's not actually about the adversity. It's how you deal with the adversity that I think is the most telling. And to your point, it's about plugging those holes and gaps in the dam as you're building that really tell you that you're an entrepreneur. Now, the other point that I think it's worth saying is, look, there, and you know, you said yourself, some people wait half their lives to be an entrepreneur. There is no, you know, there is no shame, and I think shame is probably even the wrong word, but there is no shame in being an employee, going to work and putting in your time. But if you have that spark, I think today there has never been a better time to be an entrepreneur. There just really hasn't. With the amount of capital that you need to go out and launch a business, with the you know, the lack of friction that there is to test out ideas, with, I think, the acceptance of failure, quote unquote, as a pathway to learning as opposed to actual failure, you know, I think no one would ever begrudge anyone who launched something and, you know, couldn't make it work for whatever reason. I think, but the learning that you get out of that is just absolutely incredible. So I think that's amazing advice. Melissa, thank you so much for your time. It's been incredible talking to you. For our listeners, where can they find you? Are you on LinkedIn? Are you on Twitter? Where is the best place for them to find you online?
Yep. I mean, I have all of the socials, but I'm probably on LinkedIn the most. That's how you know when you're getting older. But you can also find loads more information about us. If you just search Nourish or Get Nourished, you can find it online. And yeah, honestly, I would love to hear from any aspiring entrepreneurs. I really enjoy talking to people who are just starting that journey. And like you just said, I thought that point was extremely good. And I would love to close on that. You don't have to get it right the first time. You just have to have the right sentiment. You know, I think that's absolutely right. Very few people get it right the first time.
Amazing. Melissa, thank you so much. It's been wonderful speaking to you.
You too. Thanking you. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. Follow us on social and at nothingventured.tech to make sure you never miss another episode. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can support us by giving us 5 stars on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. We love to hear from our listeners to understand the topics and guests that they'd like to hear about and from most. Drop us a message via the links in the show notes, and thanks again for your support.